Well, the lights are all on, so I guess current state is a go here for Monday. We're glad you're back. I'm Mark Bayshore. If you are without power, hopefully it won't be long before you've got it back. It sounds like you're listening with help from batteries this morning, probably. MSU researchers are embarking on a study to help alleviate critical hunger problems. We will learn more about that here coming up in just a little bit on Current State. In the meantime, we are glad you're here for Monday. Last Thursday, Senate Republicans in the state legislature rushed through a bill that would alter campaign finance rules here in Michigan. The changes include doubling the limits nearly across the board on campaign contributions. The bill also seeks to ensure that so-called dark money remains just that, dark, as it will allow financial backers of so-called issue ads to remain anonymous. The effort stymies an attempt by Secretary of State Ruth Johnson to require disclosure of who pays for those issue ads. Supporters of non-disclosure say such provisions harm free speech. Here to help us sort out what all this means is Rich Robinson. Rich is the executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Welcome, Rich. And joining him is Gideon DeSandro, the communications director for the Michigan Freedom Fund. Welcome, Gideon.
Thank you.
Rich Robinson, let's start with you. What do you make of what happened last Thursday?
Well, it was kind of a mixed bag as far as the Secretary of State's communications. In the first place, she denied the request of the State Bar of Michigan to require disclosure of the funders of issue advertising, quote-unquote, issue advertising in judicial campaigns. Her statement said she, in effect, could not divide the baby, so rather than require disclosure for all campaigns, she elected to say that there should be disclosure for no campaigns. Now, on the other hand, she released a news release saying that she was proposing to the Department of Legislature, whatever, Regulatory Affairs, an administrative rule process that would ultimately lead to the kind of disclosure of funders of issue advertising that she had been requested to act on.
And Gideon DeSandro, the Michigan Freedom Fund, supports supports the non-disclosure aspect here. Why? Why is that a good policy?
Issue ads are just different than election ads. Issue ads, going back to the writing of the Constitution and upheld through Supreme Court ruling after Supreme Court ruling all the way until the present time, have been used by Americans as a way to safely speak out against the government. It's a way to talk about issues and to frame our national debate in a safe way, without fear of intimidation, and it doesn't benefit any particular candidate. They were written into the Constitution specifically to have a place for anonymous political speech. The current setup is a way to codify that belief, and I think the system works as it is.
Let's take a step back and just remind our listeners what these issue ads are exactly. We've got an example here from the 2012 state Supreme Court election.
Johnson Kelly McCormick. Tough on crime? Hardly. Johnson Kelly McCormick had the wrong priorities to protect Michigan families. Johnson has a record of questionable judgment, putting communities at risk. McCormick volunteered to represent terrorists at Guantanamo Bay and fought to protect sexual predators. And Kelly is a former appointee of scandal-ridden Wayne County executive Bob Ficano. Tell Johnson Kelly and McCormick that Michigan families need judges to protect them, not criminals.
Rich Robinson, what do you find objectionable about that kind of ad?
Nothing objectionable about it other than the fact that it wasn't reported to the Department of State and it wasn't part of the normal disclosure system. This is not an attempt in any way to preclude free speech. Make it as nasty as you want to be. Make it sweeter than saccharin. But the object of the request of the State Bar of Michigan was to get a disclosure of ads like this one that was not an issue ad. This was the functional equivalent of express advocacy. You know, the Supreme Court ruled in a decision called Federal Election Commission against Wisconsin Right to Life that authentic issue advocacy doesn't talk about candidates or parties or challengers. They tried to provide some indices so people could discriminate between what really is issue advocacy and what is merely a campaign ad, being coy with the use of its language.
Candidates are specifically referred to in the example
that's
we just
right.
heard. Gideon, the State Bar of Michigan's been concerned about, as Rich has pointed out, has been concerned about this in judicial elections. In the 2012 state Supreme Court election, only $3 million of the $18 million spent on ads from both sides of the campaign was from identified sources. Proponents like Rich argue that this violates due process. How do you respond to that argument? Doesn't it make sense that one should know if their opponent in a courtroom has donated money to the judge who's going to decide their case?
No, I don't think that there's any role for that. I think that the judge shouldn't know who's donated money to them or toward their election or against them or toward an issue that they care about. That's why there's a difference between election speech and issue ads. The election speech are the ads that are supposed to be explicitly for a candidate or against a candidate. And those are the ones you want to put your name on because you're asking the people to trust you. You're asking the people to trust you as a candidate for public office, or you're asking the people not to trust your opponent for public office. So, it's by its nature a personal appeal, and that's why we put their name on it.
What makes that last ad we just heard, though, an issue ad opposed to a candidate ad?
It's not about her suitability for office. It's not asking you to vote against her. It's not asking you to vote for her opponent. It's just raising issues with her public past and her actions as an appointee of Bob Ficano, her decisions to defend controversial criminals. I mean, those are the sorts of issues that we should be having a public debate over. Those are the sorts of issues that we should be questioning our public officials about. That's the explicit purpose of issue ads, is to allow people a safe space to speak out against their government. And
that requires anonymity, in your view?
For some people, it does. That's the interesting thing. The Supreme Court, throughout the history of the United States, has said that not everyone's going to speak out in this way. But for some people, anonymity is required for them to be able to speak out. And so we need to keep that channel open to give everyone the right to free speech.
Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville was quoted in the Free Press as saying, the Supreme Court already made this decision that these donors don't have to be disclosed. And so we codified what the Supreme Court did. But there appears to be some confusion here because, contrary to what many people think, the Citizens United ruling supports disclosure. Here is Bruce Cortade, then president of the State Bar of Michigan, on Current State back in September.
The Supreme Court recognized that the disclosure of contributors to election campaigns is a governmental interest in providing the electorate with information about election-related spending resources. So Citizens United supports the disclosure. So especially in a situation here where, unlike a normal political campaign, where you don't have to worry about, you know that a politician is going to get lobbied, you know that things like that are going on. In a judicial campaign, you have the right to know, has your judge received money? Should your judge step aside?
Rich Robinson, so when the dust settles on Citizens United specifically, where does that leave us?
Well, Part 4 of Citizens United was a very strong statement in favor of disclosure. Let me quote, "The First Amendment protects political speech, and disclosure permits citizens and shareholders to react to the speech of corporate entities in a proper way. This transparency allows the electorate to make informed decisions and give proper weight to different speeches and messages." This part of Citizens United was very clear. If there's any ambiguity, it's about what is or is not an issue advertisement or an issue message. And again, going back to Wisconsin Right to Life, it's an effort to lobby on a legislative matter, grassroots lobbying, to motivate listeners to contact a public official who can act on a matter. Well, in Michigan, judges are not lobbyable officials. There's no such thing is authentic issue advocacy in a judicial campaign.
What about that point, Gideon, the fact that that you should be entitled to lobby an elected official or an elected legislative official, but not a judicial official?
Well, I think the Supreme Court's been very clear over time that the anonymity in issue ads is supposed to be protected. And so I agree with Rich that the key question here is whether or not it's an issue ad or an election ad. And I think the Supreme Court ruling that's laid out much of our current campaign finance law, Buckley v. Valeo, has really set the standard for what constitutes an issue ad or an election ad. An election ad has to have very specific language: vote for, vote against, oppose, support. And these judicial ads that count as issue ads simply don't have that. And so I understand that for a lot of people that there's a thin line between them, but the Supreme Court has decided since the Constitution was written that there is a place for anonymous speech, and we need to err on the side of caution with this to make sure that our First Amendment rights are protected.
Rich, talk to us about your interpretation of this distinction.
Well, Buckley was not the last word on campaign finance jurisprudence from the U.S. Supreme Court. Let me quote.
This is Buckley v. Valeo.
This is 1976, after the Watergate reforms. And what one of the main things that happened was to say that spending in elections cannot be limited. Contributions can, because they carry a risk of corruption of a public official. But in 2003, in McConnell against FEC, the Supreme Court said that the express advocacy standard from Buckley is functionally meaningless. And again, to go back to Wisconsin Right to Life, issue ads take no position on a candidate's character, qualification, or fitness for office. Now, the ad that you played was an example of the kind of advocacy that is certainly characterizing the suitability to hold office of a candidate. It was not lobbying that particular judge or any of the judges mentioned.
You've referred to the U.S. Supreme Court ruling several times, but if we've been going off that ruling ever since, it begs the question, why doesn't the current Secretary of State, Ruth Johnson, just issue a different interpretation and call for disclosure?
Well, I think that's exactly the point. She's punted on this to an administrative rule process that's not the appropriate response. Her responsibility in office would be to vacate an interpretive statement made by Secretary of State Terry Land in 2004, which said, unless there are words of express advocacy from Buckley against Valeo, any kind of a campaign message is not express advocacy. Therefore, it's not a campaign expenditure. Therefore, it doesn't have to be disclosed.
And we've been operating according to that ever since.
That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Gideon, DeSandro, what's next for this bill politically? Do you have a take on that?
Well, the Senate did what they're supposed to do. They, whether or not we like it, the difference between issue ads and election ads is the current law in the state of Michigan. It's the current Secretary of State's ruling. It's the prevailing law. And so the Senate took a situation where there was ambiguity and confusion about the law, and they explicitly wrote the difference into state law. That's good public service unless you don't like the current law. So they did what they're supposed to do. The bill now goes to the House, and it sounds like the House is of the same mind. Hopefully, they'll also uphold the current law, and we'll see our First Amendment rights defended in the state House.
We seem to be getting some mixed signals from the governor's office. Do you have any thoughts on where Governor Snyder stands?
I don't know personally, though I will say a lot of these mixed messages are coming from other people talking about the governor rather than the governor himself. We'll see where he is soon enough.
Rich, any thoughts on the legislative process ahead?
Well, I think the Senate Bill 661, before it had this slapdash amendment in committee last Thursday, was a bad bill to begin with. Quite literally, 99.99% of Michiganders never have an encounter with a campaign finance contribution limit. It is literally 1% of 1% of Michiganders who are affected by our contribution limits. That's a statistical truth. So this was a sop to 1 in 10,000 Michiganders who want to buy a greater share of campaign finance action so they can exercise greater influence in all things political. Now, this amendment that was rushed through on Thursday morning after an hour-long recess attempted to make the act forever more bulletproof from any disclosure if you're coy with your use of language. I suspect it's not going to succeed. Margins are closer in the House. For those who are judged to be in marginal districts in the Senate, they were allowed to take a walk. And I'm not sure that anybody wants to go on record as being an enabler of dark money going into an election year.
Gideon, contributions were effectively doubled by this. What do you think the impact of that is?
Well, I think
doesn't that just benefit the people with deep pockets already even more?
I think it benefits all of us in that it gives us all a greater right to free speech. It gives us all greater access to free speech. Just because we don't all exercise our free speech in that way to the greatest extent doesn't mean we don't deserve that right. That's the entire point of the Bill of Rights. It's to defend the minority from the tyranny of the majority. The Constitution and the Bill of Rights defend the rights of every single American, not just the vast majority of us, not just 99.99% of us. They are supposed to keep the right to free speech protected for every single American.
But doesn't the minority really have – the tiny minority are the ones with the deeper pockets.
They choose this way to express their free speech. But the point is that it's open for anyone. Anyone can express their free speech in this way. And the Supreme Court's upheld that idea. They've said that to limit the free speech of some to empower others who choose not to express their rights in that way is wrong. It's antithetical to the entire First Amendment.
Rich, care to respond?
Well, I should just say there certainly are no limits on what anyone can spend in political campaigns in Michigan. But you must make an independent expenditure if you want to do unlimited spending. What this allows is twice as much leverage directly with candidates for office and ultimately office holders. That's the point of this, to double the direct leverage over office holders.
Bruce Cortade of the State Bar also told us in September on this program that polling suggests 96% of the public support identifying these funding sources. Isn't that significant, Gideon?
Sure. I mean, when you call it dark money or you call it people most likely associate it with negative campaign ads because that's just what it's become over the last decade or so, they're not popular. But the fact of the matter is that it's a free speech issue and that we have to defend our rights whether or not they're expressed in a popular way or an unpopular way. Whether or not you like seeing these ads on TV, it is our right to be able to speak out against our government. It's something that was very important to the founders of this country. It was the basis of the First Amendment. It's the way they spoke out against their government and created ours. The right to free speech and the right to anonymously speak out against the government is just tantamount to being an American.
Okay. Rich Robinson is the executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. We just heard from Gideon DeSandro, who is the communications director for the Michigan Freedom Fund. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. Hunger and malnourishment have plagued parts of Africa for generations, and nearly as long as the problem has existed, scientists have been looking for solutions to the vexing complexities surrounding mass hunger. Just a few weeks ago, a team of MSU researchers received nearly $1.5 million from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to explore the benefits of a new type of crop called the perennial grain.
This new research has the potential to alleviate chronic malnutrition in certain parts of Africa, and here to tell us more is the project's director, Sig Snap. Sig is an MSU professor of crops and soil ecology at the Kellogg Biological Station. Welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark.
What is a perennial crop, first of all? Let's make that distinction.
Certainly, it's a whole new type of crop. Usually, we grow crops for about 4 or 5 months. They're in the ground. Then we take a combine and we harvest them, right? Then there's nothing there for the next 6 months. However, this type of crop actually keeps growing. It comes back from the root and gives us a bit more capture of sunlight and certainly protects the soil for another 6 months and then gives us another crop at the end of about 11 months. So,
what crops are you looking at that at, and have they been around for a while, or are these new breeds?
They're kind of a new variation on an old theme.
Okay.
Believe it or not, in the 1930s, the Russians came up with something called perennial wheat, and then it was just sidelined. It was just kind of too far out there. So about 10 years ago, the Land Institute in Kansas and Washington State University revisited this idea of a perennial wheat crop that could keep regrowing each year for 3-4 years, kind of like your turf grass might do, just keep regrowing. And so that's kind of got the idea going.
You'll be focusing on Africa. Where exactly?
We're focusing in on five prototype areas. And those were particularly in Tanzania, Malawi, also in Ethiopia, as an example of northern Africa, where wheat is grown now, and then also Mali and Ghana in West Africa. So three regions, five countries.
Let's talk a little bit more again about the crops, though, that you are focusing on here, the perennials. Tell us about them each briefly.
Sure. So perennial wheat, as I mentioned, is a variation of annual wheat that we currently grow. Then there's sorghum. Perennial sorghum is a crop that is grown for a grain in Africa. Here in the U.S., it's used for mostly livestock feed. But it's a food, very important food in West Africa. So it makes sense to try out perennial sorghum. It's been developed again at Land Institute in Kansas and bring it to West Africa, see how it grows. Then finally, we have a version of a perennial legume. It's kind of like a bushy soybean. And it is being grown. I mean, there's a traditional type that is grown in southern Africa, Malawi. And also this is grown in the Caribbean and in India, but usually as a one-year bush. And so we're trying it out for 2 or 3 years. Pigeon pea, that one's called.
Pigeon pea.
Yes, pigeon pea.
Now, can any of these, would any of these be considered GMOs, genetically modified?
So far, the breeders have managed to produce them using traditional means by crossing the perennial relatives, such as grasses, with annual wheat, and then keep back crossing until they get the type of annual wheat that you and I use for bread. And then, but it still has the perennial trait like a grass.
Now, would that be a concern if any of these were genetically modified for you?
Well, in Africa, there's many places where it's not legal yet. I think only in South Africa can GMOs be currently grown. So it's good that these prototypes are all non-GMO so that actually legally they can be tried out in these different parts of Africa.
You have a multidisciplinary team that you've assembled. Tell us about them.
Absolutely. I'm very excited that we're bringing together three different colleges at Michigan State, including a crop breeder, crop modeler from geology. Co-PI is Joe.
Geology is involved?
Yes,
really?
Geology. Dr. Bruno Basso, recent hire at MSU. We have Dr. Joe Messina is the co-PI, so my partner in crime here, and he's is doing some of the mapping of where these new crops would grow, so he's in the geography department. Then we have in Department of Community Sustainability, we have Dr. Robbie Richardson and Dr. Laura Schmidt-Olabisi, a modeler and a social economist. So we're all working together to, and it takes these different types of interdisciplinary efforts to map out where this new crop type might do well in Africa.
We're talking with Dr. Sig Snap, an MSU professor of crops and soil ecology at the Kellogg Biological Station about work that she is about to launch in Africa on perennial crops, there's a cultural aspect to this as well. You have to think about the way people eat and sell food. What will you be looking at there?
Well, I want to emphasize that this isn't a done deal. We're not just extending these as a silver bullet to solve people's problems in Africa. This is a collaborative project with African experts. We're trying to see which of these crops might fit where. We think they have tremendous potential to even transform agriculture because, as I said, they grow for 11 months instead of the traditional 4 or 5 months. But on the other hand, we want to make sure that they meet local needs. You know, people have very specific culinary traits that they're looking for. Mm-hmm. So we are working closely with African experts to make sure that these address, you know, different priorities. For example, sometimes labor is very short in some parts of Africa. So we want to see, will these reduce labor requirements or will they increase them?
You'll be measuring. You'll be doing an awful lot of measuring, from what I understand, yields and soil erosion and labor measurements that you have to make as well. Tell us about that.
Well, we hope to do that over the next decade. I mean, this is a long-term project. These are perennials. It takes time for them to regrow and for us to see what their yield is over 3-4 years. This is just the first step. It's a 2-year scoping grant. So we will actually be doing much more of evaluating, mapping, trying to see what will fit where, and expert opinion. We hope then to scale out some of these in the next few years. We only actually have crops on the ground in 2 countries at this point.
So your timeline, you're basically focusing on the next 2 years.
That's what this grant is covering. It's $1.5 million to scope out the potential risks and benefits of these new types of crops in different parts of Africa.
And the countries you're going to is determined largely by soil, by climate, by the conditions under which these perennial crops would grow?
Yes, and these are priority countries. USAID Feed the Future Initiative and also Gates Foundation have gone together and decided these 5 countries represent many of the different conditions in Africa and represent new market opportunities for growth in Africa. And so they chose these as priority countries, and we're coming in to see how these different crops might thrive there.
How much research do you have to go off of now regarding perennial crops? I mean, where are you starting from?
That's a really good question. There was just a meeting in Rome, the FAO from United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, and they brought together experts, about 30 from around the world, in perennial grains. In fact, there's a number of videos of from that meeting of convening of experts. And it was pointed out that actually there hasn't been much invested yet in this. So a lot of people have done this as a hobby. So I would say we're really starting at the beginning here. A lot of excitement. We have a lot of new tools to bring to the table to check these out, such as mapping. We have much better information these days about different types of socioeconomic conditions. And, you know, MSU is an expert in African studies. And so we bring a lot to the table, but we're really at ground zero.
How much time do you expect to be spending in Africa here in the next couple of years?
Well, me and my team, we will be doing numerous trips to Africa. There's an extensive consultation that's going to be going on.
Where do you hope to be by the end of the grant? What's realistic and what's ideal?
That's a great question, Mark. Our goal is to both have maps of where these crops would thrive and what would be some of their environmental benefits, such as erosion protection, conservation of soil. And we expect to have pilot studies which have identified what are the next steps. Should there be more investments in genetics? Should there be more investments in participatory modeling, socioeconomics? What are the next steps that will test how these can make a difference in food security, as you said?
So there are advantages to some of these beyond productivity and nutrition. Some of them play a role in soil erosion. Some of them resist soil erosion better than others.
That's where these are transformative.
Okay. Is specifically in soil erosion?
Yes. Okay. We know that because perennials such as alfalfa or some of these perennial biofuel crops, we know that we can improve soils and reduce losses.
Well, plus they stay in the ground longer, I would think.
Exactly. Just the fact they're growing protects the soil.
Yeah.
But what we don't know is how much food we can produce. Because unlike alfalfa, hay, or perennial biofuels, these actually produce food. But how much and what type is important?
It's all very interesting. We've received a $1.5 million grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which will enable a team of MSU researchers to study perennial crops in Africa. We want to thank our guest, Sig Snap, an MSU professor of crops and soil ecology at the Kellogg Biological Station. Thank you and good luck.
Really appreciate this opportunity.
Startup companies between the Lansing and Flint metro areas have a new resource to help them get off the ground. Baker College in Owosso is the site of a new business incubator known as the REV Center, which stands for Realizing Entrepreneurial Vision. It's the first such facility in Shiawassee County. The REV Center hosted its open house recently, and here to talk about it and the road ahead is Lorraine Austin, the REV Center coordinator. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Sure. It's a pleasure to have you. Explain the premise of the REV Center here. Do you have a business model, for example?
There are various business incubators around the state, actually. We're a little bit broader than perhaps some of them. We will work with entrepreneurs and startup companies to help them proceed, sort of navigate the field. The Shiawassee County region has a lot of economic development organizations, but sometimes as an entrepreneur, you're not really sure where to go, what to do next, what kind of a plan to follow. And so we're here to kind of serve that role as a navigator, as it were.
An incubator often provides space. Do you offer space, other kinds of resources?
We do, and we have private office space available, or if our clients would like to use a communication space to meet with their clients, we have a room that they can rent. Various options that way as well. We also have a message center that they can utilize. Let's say they're a one-person operation and they're a landscaper, they're out in the field, they're not able to answer the phone. We can provide those sorts of services as well.
How did the REV Center get started?
Well, actually, there was a feasibility study that was done in August 2012, and it was done by the University of Michigan's Center for Business Acceleration and Incubation Studies, Institute for Research on Labor, Employment, and the Economy. And after that was done in cooperation with a number of different local organizations, it was realized that not only was it something that was needed in Shiawassee County, but could benefit various segments of the population.
But is it publicly funded, or is there private money involved as well?
Currently, our funding is pretty much through Baker College. We also have a grant from the Cook Family Foundation, which is a local family foundation.
And what do we know about the business climate in Shiawassee County? You alluded to other economic development organizations in the county. What is the current economy like in the county?
Well, again, we've been hit with the declining auto industry and major manufacturing, but we're picking up. And again, through the business incubator, we're really trying to focus on these small entrepreneurial, small business startups.
Can you tell us how many tenants do you have right now?
Currently, we're just started and we're working.
You just launched.
We just launched actually 2 weeks ago. We're working with a test client, the Downtown Owosso Farmers Market, and that's been a really interesting collaboration because they're sort of their mini incubator as well. They have lots of different vendors that occur with the market. So we're working not only with the market, but some of the vendors who, you know, make jams or develop woodworking crafts and things like that. So we will be working with some of their clients as well.
You are, a lot of Shiawassee County is pretty rural. Does that play into this at all? I mean, is that a factor here in moving ahead with the Rev Center?
Well, I think only because perhaps some of the folks who are interested in starting their own business are not really used to how to go about doing that. We're kind of spread out, but I think people know where to go. And that's sort of the one thing we really want to do with the Rev Center is be that one-stop shop where our entrepreneurs, our clients can come and say, geez, I don't know who to talk to about this. Do I go to the Chamber of Commerce? Do I go to the Economic Development Partnership? Do I go to Baker College? How about the Small Business and Technology Development Center? What do they provide? When do we go there? We'd love to be that one-stop shop. They pick up the phone, ask us where to go, create that development plan month to month so that they know for the first month, gee, I'll do these first three things. How did we go with that first month? Did we get those things done? If we had any problems with that, how can we proceed from there? And again, they have a craft, they have a skill, they have something that they are passionate about, but perhaps they don't have that business acumen, and that's what we want to do, is sort of match them up with people who can help them out.
We're talking with Lorraine Austin, who's the coordinator of the Rev Center in Owosso, which is serving Shiawassee County. It's Rev stands for Realizing Entrepreneurial Vision. How are you? You had your open house here recently. How else do you plan to market what you offer?
Well, I think a lot of it will be word of mouth. We're certainly marketing it through our collaborators, which again are the Chamber of Commerce, the Economic Development Partnership, Baker College of Owosso, and the SBTDC. Through Baker College of Owosso, one of the exciting pieces that we're working with are the students, because we have an entrepreneurial program there that will be using interns through our Rev Center. We also hope that our clients will be able to use some of those interns as well, so that students who are in that entrepreneurial program can, before they actually get their degree, have some experience starting those small businesses.
I've heard it said that since the Great Recession that a greater percentage of Americans do think in terms of their own small business. Do you agree with that, and do you see any of that unfolding in Shiawassee County?
Absolutely. I can't tell you the number of people I've spoken to just in the past 6 months who have said, you know, I've always wanted to open my own fill in the blank. Uh-huh. And I think for some, it's just a pipe dream. They think there's too much work involved. They're not talented enough for some reason. They think that there are obstacles. What we'd like to do is just have them give us a call and have that first consultation. Maybe it is a pipe dream. We can talk to them honestly and openly about what it is that they're doing. We're looking for folks who are looking to grow their business. If it's a hobby business, more power to them, but it's not. We're looking for folks who are actually looking to add employees, and we're also looking for folks who are in the Shiawassee County region. That could include folks from Clinton County or Genesee County as well.
An awful lot of people in the past, I know, have commuted to Flint when Flint was, when General Motors was employing 80,000 people. Quite a few people of those people came from Shiawassee County, so that's been quite a transition here.
Absolutely. And again, we're hoping folks will take that transition and see it as an opportunity to maybe start life anew.
How long can a business stay at the incubator?
We ask them to stay no longer than 3 years. We go on a year-to-year contract with them. And again, we're hoping by that third year that they've developed enough that they can be no longer a fledgling business, but they can fly out on their own.
How about angel investing? Is that available in Shiawassee County?
Currently, right now, we're not focusing on that, but we really hope to pursue that at some point in the future.
Okay. And you come from where? How did you become the director of the Rev Center?
Boy, that's a long story. I was actually born and raised in Shiawassee County. And as many folks do, when high school is finished, they wanted to get out as soon as possible. So I've been out and about. I actually worked in New York City for 13 years, but now I've come back and would just I'm a networker by trade is what I am. They saw that as a good skill for this particular piece. We have, as I say, the economic development organizations and talent in Shiawassee County are numerous. What is needed is sometimes I call myself a matchmaker. I try try to take these folks who are coming in and introduce them to be it a business service provider that can help them, perhaps a mentor. We have lots of different retirees that I've spoken to in Shiawassee County who really miss that piece, who think to themselves, gosh, if I had only known this when I started, it would certainly have saved me a lot of trouble. There's so many people like that, just willing and able to help these new folks, that what we really want to do is just match those folks up together and for the success of everyone.
Do you want to line up more investors?
Yes, at some point we certainly do. We're going to be working with banks for that sort of financial piece at this point. But again, since we're just starting, we want to get our clients ready. We want to match them up with the people who can help them. That financial piece isn't something that we're focusing on right now.
Does it surprise you that you're the first in the whole county?
I suppose yes and no. It is a smaller county. And again, as you say, most people are sort of thinking, well, I'll go to Flynn, I'll go to Lansing when mm-hmm. I have those pieces to go to. But we're thinking, hey, why not stay locally? You know, we've got a lot of talent here.
I've spent a lot of time in Shiawassee County. I was glad to read about this development.
Well, good.
And we want to thank you. Lorraine Austin is the coordinator of the REV Center. That stands for Realizing Entrepreneurial Vision. It is Shiawassee County's first business incubator. Thanks, Lorraine, and good luck.
Thank you so much.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. 55 years ago today, the gales of November claimed the lives of 33 crew members of the SS Carl D. Bradley on Lake Michigan. The Bradley wreck doesn't get talked about as much as the Edmund Fitzgerald, but it is a story worth remembering. Current state's Melissa Benmark spoke with Bruce Lynn, the executive director of the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum at Whitefish Point, about what happened that day.
It was November 17th, 1958. The Carl Bradley, if for any of you who've seen ships traveling in the Great Lakes, this at one time was the largest ship on the Great Lakes, 640 feet long, not that much shorter than the Edmund Fitzgerald. But it was one of those old stories. It was the last trip of the season, and they had unloaded some limestone down in Gary, Indiana, U.S. Steel plant down there. And they were turning around, and they were headed back north. Home port was Rogers City, and they were approaching the Beaver Island chain. And to make a long story short, with 65-mile-per-hour winds and 20 to 20-foot waves or 25-feet waves, the Bradley literally broke apart on the surface. It's about 12 miles southwest of Gull Island. And within a matter of minutes, this 640-foot vessel with its 35-man crew was sinking to the bottom of Lake Michigan. The interesting thing, I think, about this shipwreck is that there were two survivors. So you had 33 crew members that perished on the wreck. You did have two survivors. And so unlike, say, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, where there were no survivors and we don't know exactly what happened, now we have two eyewitnesses that could tell that story of what was happening, what they saw with their crew and how quickly the ship sank, and so on and so forth.
I understand there were four survivors, but two of them didn't make it.
That's correct. Well, that's right. There was a life raft. And most of the information that I've researched comes from the survivor that's actually still alive, Frank Mays. He tells the story when the bow section of the ship rolled over and started to sink. He was ejected from the vessel, but was lucky enough to land very close to that life raft. So he saw much of what was happening, and it was soon after that the first mate of the ship, a gentleman by the name of Elmer Fleming, appeared near the raft, and Frank Mays pulled him on board. And then two other crew members came on board, but in the end, when the Sundew, the Coast Guard cutter, came through to rescue them, only Elmer Fleming and Frank Mays were alive at that point.
So Elmer Fleming is no longer with us then?
No. In the late 1960s, if I understand correctly, Elmer Fleming died of a heart attack.
But Frank Mays went on to actually dive the wreck of the Bradley, which blows my mind.
He did. He did. And one can only imagine what was going through his mind when he went down in that submersible and saw his old ship, you know, this beautiful, what was a beautiful ship at one time, in two pieces on the bottom of the lake. And I think that was one thing, one reason he wanted to go down, because there was some contention, a bit of a debate whether that ship sank in one piece or if it went down in two pieces. And what can you say? Frank saw it happen. So
right, but wasn't there some kind of investigation that U.S. Steel, I think, was the owner of the ship at the time, and they had some investigation, and they said that it was in one piece?
That's correct. That's correct. That Bradley Transportation Line was owned by U.S. Steel, and U.S. Steel did indicate that after their investigation that it had gone down in one piece.
So Frank Mays saw it on the bottom in two pieces. That must have been really vindicating for him.
Absolutely. I can't even, again, I can't imagine what was going through his mind. I mean, think of anybody going into 340, 350 feet of water in a submersible, much less you having been on a shipwreck in 1958, and now you're going down to the gravesite, really, of that wreck.
Does he kind of avoid talking about it now, or does he talk about it, his experiences at all, or...
You know, he does a little bit. He did come to the Shipwreck Museum at one time and spoke about his experiences. But I don't think that he goes out on any kind of, you know, speaker's tour or anything like that. I don't think that he does that a whole lot.
One of the other really striking details that I, when I was doing the research on this, was how people all lined up on the beach, I guess at Charlevoix, with their car lights on when it went down looking for survivors.
That's right. Yeah. You had a lot of the Coast Guard families that were out there, because you had two of those cutters, and there were even other vessels that were out there that night that were searching. But you had a lot of the Coast Guard families, but at the same time, you had a lot of those families from Roger City, from Sheboygan, from Onaway, places like that, that were driving over because they knew, as terrible as that storm was, they wanted to be there when their family member was coming back. At least they were praying that they would see their family member come back alive.
The effect on Roger City must have been pretty profound. 23 of 35 crew members from there.
That's correct. And if you think, there was a statistic, and it was something like 53 children were now fatherless. And there was a statistic that this was suddenly the highest per capita orphaned children number on the Great Lakes immediately after that. And it all happened really in a matter of minutes, if you think about it.
You direct this museum, the Shipwreck Museum. You're right off of the observation of the 30th anniversary of the Fitzgerald. On kind of a philosophical level, I wonder, people have such a personal reaction to shipwrecks. It's almost more like a collective loss. The immediate family and relatives obviously have lost people very dear to them. But there's almost this collective loss that we feel, or many of us do anyway, like we all own it. Is this just a Great Lakes thing, do you think, because we live here? Or why do you think so many of us see these events, you know, as if they belong to us in some way?
That's an interesting question, and I've been asked questions like that before, and a lot of it revolves around this kind of continuing interest in the Edmund Fitzgerald. I don't think it's Great Lakes, and you know, a good example we always think about is Titanic. Everybody seems to have a connection to that, and a lot of times, personally, I know, I try to think of what I would have done under the circumstances. Or you read about these shipwrecks, you do research, you talk to surviving crew members who have been on shipwrecks, and you hear them recount the story, and I always find myself imagining myself in that position. I think people do that a lot. There is a little bit of romance behind these things, obviously not for the people that were going down on the ships, but the heroism, the courage. You think about people maybe sometimes doing certain things that will allow another member on the ship to survive, and they don't. Think about the heroism of the Coast Guard, typically, or even civilians, or even in some situation, lighthouse keepers going out and saving people off of shipwrecks. So it is interesting, that fascination that seems to cling to shipwrecks. And, you know, we see it every year up there at the museum. We have about 60,000 people a year that come through the museum. And it is interesting to talk to these people and find out why they're coming and what they're interested in. And you hear all kinds of answers, but a lot of it still revolves around that just thinking in terms of the circumstances and what would I have done under those circumstances?
Kind of an interesting side note to this. Those of us who are familiar with the Shipwreck Museum will remember some monuments on the beach that some family members made for some men who were on the Fitzgerald. When I saw them, I remember them as laminated plywood, very homemade, and it would kind of blow your mind because it just someone made this in their basement or in their shop and put it on the beach. Family members, presumably. I understand that those are no longer there.
They're not there any longer, and it's an interesting story because Sunday night, November 10th, we had a ceremony, as you just mentioned. It's a memorial for the Edmund Fitzgerald crew, and every year we have family members that come up, and we had two of the families that lost, in one case, a son, and in the other case, a father, Bruce Hudson and Ransom Cundy, and then there was a third individual that were on those markers that you're referring. They're almost like headstones. But they're right on the shore of Lake Superior. We had just been talking about those headstones, if you want to call them that, just that very night with those family members, because they were kind of getting in rough shape. The pictures were fading. They get blasted by sand throughout the spring, summer,
freezing,
and fall.
Freezing, yeah. Freeze thaw, yeah.
Well, the strange thing is, we believe that night, and that would have been 38 years ago to the day that the Fitzgerald sank, that we had a good strong wind blowing, and the waves came crashing in and swept those markers all away. 38 years to the night that the Fitz sank. Kind of boggles the mind a little bit.
Bruce Lynn, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And that wraps our show for today. Thank you very much for joining us. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks also to Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl, as well as to Aaron Young for engineering and Gabriella Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.